DW Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Today on the show, 2 years after the Egyptian revolution, a rocky path forwards for Egyptians.
Any person living under that regime, like Hafsa or any activist, would become a victim, because the regime does not allow such people to be challenging them or exposing their corruption and human rights violation.
Religious diversity becomes collateral damage in the Syrian civil war.
This is on the front line, actually. If you just look, you'll see the towers, even the tanks shelling on this village. Just being targeted day and night, every day, this area, Salma.
And why women play a crucial role in the Kurdish movement.
Our movement has been very positive for women. This struggle is not only about our identity, but about gender equality too.
All this and more on World in Progress. Hello and welcome to the show today. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Egypt's President Mohamed Morsi has declared a month-long state of emergency in the three cities where close to 50 people have been killed in protests in the last few days. The protests started Friday, January the 25th, as Egyptians marked the second anniversary of the revolt that toppled President Hosni Mubarak. But still, the violence in Egyptian cities is ongoing. Young Egyptians say the past 2 years were characterized by violent police and social injustice. This report by Matthias Seiler is presented by Sarah Steffen.
All of Tahrir Square is blocked. Barbed wire and sandbags on the roads are supposed to prevent attacks. On the once green grass square, protesters have again set up white tents. On the revolution's second anniversary, the spot is still the center of protests against the country's leadership. These days, though, the anger that swept Hosni Mubarak from power is aimed at the politics of the Muslim Brotherhood. 26-year-old Ibrahim Kenderian was living in Alexandria on the Day of Rage, as January 25, 2011 was termed. From that day on, the protests spread across the entire country. Ibrahim was drawn to the capital, Cairo. A few days later, he was part of a protest march heading toward Tahrir Square. Along the way, violence erupted and resulted in one of the most bloody street battles of the revolution.
They used everything, like rubber bullets, shotguns, tear gas. They were walking on the people with their cars.
He says that one of the police vehicles drove over two young people right before his eyes. But the protesters saw that their numbers swelled and they didn't give up until they had reached Tahrir Square. Many of them paid for their courage on this historic day with their lives. Mubarak's removal did not end the government's violence against the Egyptians fighting for freedom and social justice. Violence runs through the past 2 years like a common thread to this day. Ibrahim also suffered from this bitter experience. About a year ago, he was arrested during a street battle. The police brutally beat him, and criminals cooperating with the police stole his valuables. In the end, he was tortured for hours.
It's like pulling out arms like this, always beating us. At the point that really I at the end didn't realize how I'm getting beaten. Some people came and they said to us that you are going to be tortured again and maybe you're going to be killed.
Like many Egyptians, Ibrahim is disappointed by the developments over the past 2 years. Although Mubarak was overthrown and the military was pushed out of day-to-day politics and elections were held, the current situation doesn't seem much better, he says. Many eyewitnesses here say the new Egyptian government is restricting civil liberties and has divided the country deeply with the new constitution, but has hardly made any progress in reducing poverty. Currently, there seems to be no hope for economic recovery. Ibrahim has nothing good to say about President Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood.
They're changing nothing, they can't do anything. They don't listen to anyone, and the people are dying. People just want to eat and live.
Just a few meters from the street where he was arrested a year ago, Ibrahim recounts the story of a gas explosion which killed most of her friend's family. What he saw at the hospital truly depressed him, he says. There were no pillows, hardly any doctors, no food, and it was very filthy. Hundreds of patients there had no care.
And you have a minister of health.
what is he doing? There's a lady who talked to me who said, here it's good, in other places it's even worse. I said, you have no doctors, I said, you have no food, you have nothing. What's happening on the other places? I can't even imagine. This is Egypt.
But ironically, it is the absence of progress in Egyptians' daily lives which also gives Ibrahim some hope. Many people have realized that the Muslim Brotherhood were not the promised saviors and were unable to change the situation quickly, he says.
What is good is that it's them who are making themselves fall. By all the mistakes of the Muslim Brothers, they will fall. By all the mistakes of Mubarak, Mubarak felt. So this is what is positive. So I think that now it's time to find a leader for this revolution.
But here, too, little has changed in the past 2 years. The opposition rarely agrees on a position. It is only unanimous in its rejection of the Muslim Brotherhood, which it considers dangerous and incompetent. Ibrahim is also disappointed with the prominent opposition leaders such as Mohamed al-Baradei or Hamdine Sabahi. Al-Baradei in particular had once enjoyed full support by the revolutionary generation. But he never took the initiative or had a true vision for Egypt. Ibrahim views the second anniversary of the revolution mainly as a starting point for a new wave of protests. A growing number of Egyptians, rich as well as poor, are extremely dissatisfied with the Muslim Brotherhood's rule.
In the aftermath of the uprising, many young Egyptians were eager to help their country's transition to democracy. Now, 2 years later, they're realizing how difficult that transition can be. Noel King in Cairo has the story of a young Egyptian lawyer who went to work promoting democracy and found herself on trial.
While making coffee for a visitor using her gleaming new espresso machine, 26-year-old Hafsa Halawa admits she's not your typical young Egyptian. She grew up in England and today lives with her family in a wealthy gated community outside of Cairo. She wasn't in Egypt for the revolution. She was attending graduate school in the UK.
My revolution was on the phone with my parents here freaking out about them and going to the British Embassy, the Egyptian Embassy in Britain.
Hafsa finished her law degree a few months after the revolution and immediately moved to Cairo, excited to assist in the democratic transition. Her interest in politics led her to an American NGO called the National Democratic Institute, or NDI. She took a job helping Egyptian political parties prepare for the country's first free parliamentary elections in November of 2011.
Everyone actually needed help with the same problems because even the old guard, when it was disbanded, regrouping in a post-revolution Egypt, it's been proven that it's a whole host of egos and lack of finance and lack of, you know, basic understanding. I always joke that this country's elites and its poor are politically illiterate.
Because NDI was working with parties across the political spectrum, Hafsa didn't think her work was particularly controversial. But in December of 2011, she found herself in the middle of a diplomatic firestorm. Egyptian security forces raided the offices of more than a dozen non-governmental organizations, including NDI. They seized equipment and accused employees of spying. At first, Hafsa says she didn't realize how serious the charges were. 2 weeks later, while preparing for a work meeting, she was surrounded by police and army officers.
And they started berating me and heckling me and screaming at me that I damaged this country, that I was helping the Jewish-Israeli spies, that I was a Zionist. They had my ID card, so they saw that I was Egyptian. So they said to me, are you not afraid of your country? Haven't you done enough to your country? Enough, enough, enough. They kept screaming, enough.
The charges are simple. The NGOs were not properly registered to work in Egypt. Therefore, the employees were receiving funds in the form of their salaries illegally. In accordance with Egyptian law, Hafsa and her co-defendants are confined to a cage each time they appear in court.
It sort of has bars and it's all mesh, 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 mesh. So not only can you not hear because there are no microphones in court, you can't really see a lot either. You have to kind of have your face right up against the mess cage to see.
In an attempt to maintain her sense of humor, Hafsa tweets during the trial with the hashtag Grumpy Defendant. Egyptian political analyst Saeed Sadek says that Hafsa's case is one illustration of the challenges facing post-revolution Egypt. The country is now a democracy, but authoritarian values are ingrained in the judiciary and security forces.
Any person living under that regime, like Hafsa or any activist, would become a victim because the regime does not that allow such people to be challenging them or exposing the corruption and human rights violation. So they are always being besieged by laws, by police system that even monitors Facebook, Skype, Twitter.
But Sadiq, who teaches at the elite American University in Cairo, adds that he's surprised by how many of his students are willing to follow in Hafsa's footsteps.
I get many of the graduates who were not interested in politics, and today they are contacting me, what do I do, how can I join an NGO, how can I join a political party, what do I do exactly?
The NGO trial was recently postponed until March of this year. In the meantime, Hafsa is trying to move on with her life, but finding it difficult.
I'm angry because I've spent the last 13, 14 months now unable to work. There is a stigma now attached to being from NDI, whereby NGOs refuse to hire me because I am on trial and it would cause problems for them with state security, even though they're registered organizations. I've had 5 straight rejections because of the trial from all kinds, private sector, law firms, and from NGOs. And the answer is after trial ends.
Hafsa says she doesn't think the revolution has failed. She still has faith that Egyptians, particularly the country's youth, will help shepherd their country toward democracy. She just wishes the trial would finally end so she could get back to helping them.
That was a report by Noel King. And we're leaving Egypt for now and moving on to Syria next in World in Progress. But first, Andre Leslie will take a quick glance at some development news.
Watchdog publishes Global Press Freedom Index. Reporters Without Borders on Wednesday have given their rankings for global press freedom. The country with the most press freedom was Finland. In last place was Eritrea. The biggest gain was achieved by Malawi, which moved up 71 spots to 75th, and the biggest fall was recorded by war-torn Mali, which tumbled 74 places from its impressive previous ranking of 25th. Reporters Without Borders remain wary about the situation in the Arab Spring countries. Egypt is ranked at 151, and violence against journalists has increased in Tunisia, while Syria remains the most dangerous country for journalists. Turkmenistan and North Korea joined Eritrea again at the bottom of the table, along with Somalia and Iran. Finland, the Netherlands, and Norway retained the top 3 positions. Israel snubs UN Human Rights Review. Israel on Tuesday became the first country to boycott a UN Human Rights Council review of its rights situation. Like all 193 UN countries, Israel is required to undergo a so-called Universal Periodic Review, or UPR. But Israel has cut all contacts with the Human Rights Council last year. The Jewish state has recently come under widespread criticism for ramping up its construction of settlements in the Palestinian territories, something which the UN Human Rights Council also criticises. Israel boycotts the Human Rights Council since it claims it is being treated unfairly and accuses the council of singling it out. The review is planned to be rescheduled for later in the year. Lawyers demand inquiry into UK-Iraq abuses. Lawyers acting for nearly 200 Iraqis have gone to court to demand an independent and public investigation into abuses allegedly carried out by British troops in Iraq. The inquiry could shed a harsh light on the behaviour of British soldiers as they and their American allies struggled to control Iraq's bloody insurgency before British forces left the country in 2009. Several accounts of human rights violations by UK forces have trickled out of Iraq over the years. The British military says an inquiry is unnecessary since it is conducting its own investigations, and more than 200 cases have been settled out of court.
That was Andre Leslie with the development news. Syria's northwestern region has been a focal point of the country's civil war since last summer. In Aleppo, both sides are still locked in a deadly stalemate. But the coastal region of Latakia is less reported on in the news. Latakia, in Syria's northwest, is the historic capital of the country's Alawite sect and a power base of the Assad family. Reporter Marine Olivezi travelled to the Latakia region, where she found out that opposition forces are chipping away at the regime of Bashar al-Assad with religious diversity a collateral damage in the ongoing fighting.
Like so many other places across Syria these days, there's no time for greetings in Salma.
Get inside, please, here. Maybe it's the safest place.
As soon as we get there, Dr. Rami Habib rushes us to the basement of the field hospital. The black dot is just pierced through the clear blue sky, and soon enough, it's followed by an explosion.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
A couple of minutes later, and the helicopter is gone. Dr. Habib goes back to work. Apart from this morning's blast, Dr. Habib could almost pass for an ordinary doctor with regular patients today. A teenager with hepatitis, a small boy suffering from ear infection. But heavy casualties are just as common here.
This is on the front line, actually. If you just look, you will see the towers, even the tanks shelling on this village. Just being targeted day and night, every day. This area, Salma. Salma is the capital of the conflict in the coastal region.
Before the revolution, Salma used to be known for its spectacular view on Latakia's mountain range. Syrians from the coast, many of them Alawites, came to the Sunni retreat for fresh air and green pastures in the summertime. Now Salma is more of a ghost town, with about 500 civilians left and maybe twice as many rebel fighters. They don't have enough weapons for a breakthrough offensive, but they do have enough resilience to hold their ground. The Syrian army on the other side of the valley rains Salma with mortars and rockets, but hasn't launched a ground offensive in months. Lately, they've also been dumping barrels of TNT explosives. Free Syrian army fighters say that's what exploded earlier. They drive us to the point of impact, down a ravine. The bomb landed between the road and the river, carving out a large crater.
Yesterday we passed this road. It wasn't. It wasn't
but
here.
There's nothing here. There's not a village.
Nothing, because of this wind. You know, it's windy this day. They cannot take the target as well as they can.
The road itself was probably the target, they say. Cutting it off would isolate two opposition-held areas, and the Syrian regime has good reasons for wanting to contain rebels' advance here. Latakia province is a strategic and symbolic stronghold of the Assad regime. Its border crossing with Turkey is the only one still in the hands of the government in Syria's north. The region is also the heartland of Alawites and Bashar al-Assad's birthplace. Many Syrians believe Alawites, including the Syrian president, plan to retreat here if they lose control of Damascus. But across Latakia's hinterland, Alawites are abandoning their villages as rebels push their way deeper inside.
50-50.
Perched on high grounds, the village of Kerch used to be half Alawite, half Sunni, a religious diversity more common in small communities here than in the rest of the country. Mohamed Abu Labed, a 30-year-old Sunni, grew up with Alawite friends. On Fridays, he says they would visit each other, share tea and play ball.
So when they were
playing football, it wasn't Sunni versus Alawite, right?
Well, we could play with Tabi, could do Shia,
no, no,
the same team.
But Mohammed's friends grew apart as the revolution unfolded. He says they were convinced their fate was tied to that of the regime.
They told him they was afraid
about they will die if the regime finished. That what the regime put these things in their mind. If the regime gone, they will die. But he said to them, no, we are not like this. We are not against the Alawite, we are against the regime.
When the Free Syrian Army took control of Kurd last spring, Alawites stayed put at first, and life went on. Then weeks later, a resident spotted a group of young Alawites from the village manning a government checkpoint far from Kurd. Neighbors accused them of working as Shabihas, the name for the regime's militiamen. Mohammed says he can't imagine his childhood friends doing any harm. He hopes they didn't kill anyone. Even so, he blames them for enabling the regime to turn the revolution into a civil war. And he says he'll probably never forgive them. Alawite families left Kurd shortly after the checkpoint incident and moved to Latakia city, some 45 kilometers away. The coastal town is under control of the regime, but sectarian tensions are building there as well.
أما إذا بدك تقسم اللاذقية فالمناطق السنة محرومة من كل شيء من المازو.
Sami Najib Bekri had a management job at the state electricity company. He says resentment is growing among Sunni workers who are routinely ordered to cut power in their own neighborhood. Then 2 months ago, Bekri was given an odd assignment. He says the military asked him to break the staff into groups of 6, 2 Sunnis, 4 Alawites. Everyone received a weapon and the order to shoot in case of disruption. Bakri, who defected a month later, says these units are meant to be ad hoc militias designed for Alawites to keep in check Sunni employees. An elderly woman next to Bakri listens quietly while stroking her granddaughter's hair. Montaha has made a name for herself here by turning a house nearby Salma into a canteen for the Free Syrian Army. This Friday, a dozen fighters dip into a lavish meal of split pea soup, lentils dish, and spinach pies.
And she talked about them. They are son, they are her soul, her heart, her life. Anything they want or anything she can, she will give them.
In return, she hopes these fighters will take her back to Latakia, her hometown, and to her normal life. And that includes her Alawites' neighbors, she says, those who don't have blood on their hands. Marine Olivesi, DW, Northern Latakia Province, Syria.
January's assassination of 3 female Kurdish activists in Paris underlines the powerful role women play both on the political and military sides of the Kurdish struggle. One of the women killed was a co-founder of the PKK rebel group fighting the Turkish state for greater minority rights. For the country's pro-Kurdish movement, it's as much a struggle for gender rights as it is a struggle for minority rights, as Doreen Jones reports from Turkey.
Leading female members of Turkey's pro-Kurdish movement addressed the funeral ceremony of the 3 Kurdish women activists murdered in Paris. One of the slain women, Sakina Cansız, was a founding member of the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which has been fighting the Turkish state for greater rights. Both in the armed and political struggle for Kurdish rights, women are in a leading role, like Özlem Özen. Özlem Özen is attending a local women's group meeting. She's the head of Diyarbakır Municipality's Women's Problems Research and Application Centre. The municipality is controlled by the pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party, the BDP, and is part of their commitment to women's rights. Özlem, who is a senior member of the organisation, says gender equality is at the heart of the movement.
Ya bizim için çok önemli çünkü
Our party is attractive to women as it's the only political party that gives importance to women's rights, freedom and equality, and for them to participate in the democratic process. It has a minimum quota of 40% positions for women, as candidates and within the party. For all mayors, where a woman is not elected, there is a dual position for women. Here in Diyarbakir, in the largest district, Baglar, a woman has been elected mayor in the last 2 elections. You will find women at every level of our movement. Equality is at the center of our movement.
Sociologist Nurket Sirman of Istanbul's Bosphorus University has been studying Turkey's Kurdish minority. She says women have become a formidable force within the country's pro-Kurdish movement.
They're both within the party organization, but they're also autonomous from it. They have their own organization. They have their own decision-making bodies, and they can actually, they are the ones who decide who is going to stand for election, who's going to be within the list for an MP candidate. They try to make women's rights a central part of the party's policies, and the party has accepted that, and they have that place within the party organization. In that sense, they're very, very powerful. In the other political parties, women don't have such a space at all. It's a completely different planet.
Currently in the national parliament, 11 out of the 35 pro-Kurdish members of parliament are women. Women only make up 14% of the parliament as a whole. Shilan Esher, singing at the Diyarbakir Ferhat Cultural Centre. Along with being a popular singer, she's also a prominent member of the city's Women's Committee for the BDP. She says the political Kurdish movement has been key to transforming the region for women.
Our movement has been very positive for women. Throughout its history, it has challenged conservatism in the region. Religion was very powerful, and this oppressed women. In this region before the struggle, women had few rights. They were invisible in the home or in the fields, always one step behind the man. That's why women make up the majority of the activists. This struggle is not only about our identity, but about gender equality too.
Women joining the ranks of the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. The PKK have been fighting the Turkish state since 1984. Several of its founders were women, and women today are believed to make up more than a quarter of its ranks. The founder of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, now languishing in a Turkish jail, stressed the importance of women's equality along with Kurdish rights. That message has dictated attitudes within the country's legal Kurdish movement, according to sociologist Sirman. She says such policies have had a profound effect on many Kurdish women's lives.
Equal presence of women in all areas of Kurdish opposition has really revolutionized both the party and the conditions of life in these regions. For example, any member of the municipality who is found to have used violence against a woman in their household is fined. Women's organizations that provide support for victims of violence against women, etc. They have the power to go into these homes and they have the ability to tell people off. I mean, it's quite interesting to watch. Men are ashamed, but then they don't like it very much either, you know, so they want to say, yes, but, you know, they're kind of, you know, rejecting the way in which these women approach them. But the self-confidence with which these women go there and say, yeah, you have done wrong and you have to do this and that, it's really unbelievable.
At a Kurdish women's meeting, preparations are being made for celebrations of International Women's Day. For women in Diyarbakir, it's the highlight of the year. For Kurdish woman activist Özlem, there is still much work to do in changing men's attitudes towards women. But as women taking power is the most effective message to those who question their abilities.
Women here have shown their force, their power in politics, in fields of social services and the wider struggle. When we have the chance, we have shown what we can do. This is the biggest step in changing attitudes of society for men and for women. When women see women in charge, it empowers them and more join us. Our motto is, the more women take part in the democratic process, the stronger democracy gets.
That process seems set to continue, with women like Özlem fighting for even greater representation at all levels of the party. Dorian Jones, DW, Diyarbakir, Turkey.
And this report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll tune in again next week at the same time. In the meantime, you can find more globalization stories at dw.de/globalization. And of course, you can download World in Progress and other DW shows as podcasts as well. For today, on behalf of the Bonn studio team, Eliane Giaducci and Xenia Dencik, I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn saying thanks for listening and goodbye.